This is our last class of this year. I hope next year we will have a full year, God willing. Yes. And in order to wrap up, what I thought we would do rather than go ahead is to go over and back over, although we mentioned this before, we didn't really do it. These, I have two different sets of sheets to hand out. To go over the history of Abraham, and then to end with the Kaddish de Rabbanan, which we really should end every class with, which is the Kaddish that you're supposed to say after you studied. But today I remembered to bring a Sidur, which will remind me to say it at the end. Okay. Okay, so I want to start with the sheet when everybody gets the sheet. I want to start with the sheet that has Rashi and Rambam on it, which if you've been in the class for a long time, you got at the beginning, I think, of last year. But okay. These are two of the ten, these are two versions of the ten trials of Abraham. The Midrash says that Abraham's life was built around ten trials, but different commentators have different readings. There are two separate sheets. One says Rashi and Rambam on it. The other at the top says Abraham's trials, divine encounters with Abraham, and other divine deeds. Does everyone have one? Have both?
No, I just have the Rashi one.
Where's the extra Rashi and Rambams? They're there. Okay. Two sheets. Okay. You know what? Leave them with somebody back there, because when people come in, they're not going to come up to me to get them. Give them to Manny in the back row and to Norm, maybe they can just... Okay, great. All right, so let's start with Rashi and Rambam, and you will see, if you follow this carefully, an interesting difference between the two of them that says a lot about Jewish history. Okay, first, Rashi. The first trial that Abraham had, he hid underground 13 years from King Nimrod, who wanted to kill him. Remember reading about that in the Bible?
No,
no you don't. Okay. Now, the reason, obviously, we didn't read about this in the Bible, it's not in the Bible. I was just trying to, there's an old story about that, a rabbi who says to his congregation, next week I'm going to give a talk. There's been some accusations in the synagogue of dishonesty and of people cheating each other. So next week I'm going to give a sermon about people being dishonest and cheating each other. And in order to do that, I'd like you to all go home and read Psalm 151. So the next week everybody comes into the congregation and says, how many of you read Psalm 151? And of course everyone raises their hand. He says, well, there are only 150 psalms, so now let me give you my talk about honesty. So if anybody here had said, yes, we read about this in the Torah, we would know. But you were all good, you all said no. Abraham comes from a place called Ur Kasdim. What is an Ur? Anyone know?
Light.
It comes from the same as Ur, right? And also has another meaning, which is oven. So this Midrash developed that Abraham was, look at number two, flung into a furnace by Nimrod. Why? Because think of the motif of Moses, and for that matter, even think of the motif in the New Testament, right? About the ruler who wants to get rid of the ruler, of the person who's going to take over from him when he's a kid. Think of the myth of Oedipus, right? Why do Oedipus's parents want to get rid of him? Because they hear that one day he's going to usurp his father's throne. The idea that someone is born who's going to take over, and therefore the king wants to get rid of them, is a very common folk motif. And here it's applied to Abraham. That King Nimrod, who's the king where Abraham is born, not in Israel, hears about this man Abraham, and from a very early age seeks him out and wants to kill him. So Abraham has to hide from him, the Midrash says. He finally finds him and casts him into a fiery furnace where God protects him. Here you also hear echoes of the book of Daniel, right, where he's cast into the lion's den. And those two things, had they happened to Abraham, of course, had he had to hide for 13 years, had he been cast into a fiery furnace, would have been great trials. And for Rashi, there is no distinction, really, in terms of truth between what the rabbis say in the Midrash and what the Bible says. So as far as Rashi is concerned, if the rabbis say that he hid for 13 years from Nimrod, then he hid from Nimrod for 13 years, and that's the first trial. Also, what is interesting to note is that Rashi lived from 1040 to 1105, okay? Now, you get really extra points if anyone knows the year of the First Crusade.
It's about
1011. It's 1096. It was during Rashi's lifetime and came through Rashi's town, and Rashi knew about the Crusades, right? And suffered from the Crusades. So the idea that a king would persecute Abraham probably had a very powerful personal resonance, because the Crusades were the declaration of Pope Urban. He was the one who started it. Had he not said, let's go take Jerusalem, the Crusades never would have happened. And King Richard was especially in the later Crusades, was the principal carry-outer of the Crusades. So it may be that also what you hear is Rashi's personal experience. Impossible to know, because Rashi didn't leave us an autobiography, unfortunately. We only have little fragments about him, mostly from himself and his grandchildren, who turned out to be crucial commentators on the Torah. Okay, so you have Abraham hiding from King Nimrod is the first trial, and then flung into the fiery furnace is the second, and then only the third is he's commanded to leave his family and his homeland, which both Rashi and Rambam see as a trial. Rambam begins his 10 with he had to leave his family and his homeland. And why do you suppose Rambam in particular would begin with that? Because he had to leave his family and his homeland. Right, and he does, and obviously he only is using things that are in the Bible. All of Rambam's are in the Bible, which we'll see. But also, Rambam came from Cordoba. He eventually fled Spain because of the Almohad persecutions, and he lived his life in Cairo, in Fostat, which was right outside Cairo, is now part of Cairo, apparently. And so Rambam knew what it was to leave home as a very young man.
How young?
He was, I think, at the time a child, like 7 or 8, if I remember properly. He had an older brother, David, it's a sad story. He had an older brother, David, who made a good living as a merchant while Rambam studied, because Rambam, obviously, from a very early age, I mean, you're not that great a genius without being clearly very bright, very young. David died at sea, and we have Maimonides' personal comments about how he was affected for years afterwards. I mean, he clearly went into a very deep depression. He talks about the fact that, you know, he couldn't work and he couldn't think and he almost couldn't get out of bed and so on when he heard what happened to his brother David. I don't know what year he left. Rambam was born in 1135, and I don't remember what year he came to Fostat, but it shouldn't be hard to find out. I was going to say there are a lot of good biographies of Rambam, but you probably Google Maimonides and Wikipedia, it'll tell you what year he left for Cairo. But notice, the other thing to notice about this, and this is a longer discussion for another time, is when you think about how religions persecute other religions, notice Maimonides left a Muslim world for a different Muslim world, because they're never consistent, you know? And like in today, you have Iraq, but you also have Dubai. You know, you have some Muslim kingdoms that are very severe and others that are very tolerant. And the same thing was true in the time of Rambam. He lived in Fostat. He was the physician to the Sultan. He was esteemed. He was, you know, he lived a very comfortable life. I mean, his life was difficult in lots of other ways, but not because of persecution. So So it's always, I mean, the history of things like that are always more complicated than any generalization. And the Almohads were vicious, and the worst, I mean, just about the worst of Muslim persecution. But the same thing happened when the, you know, Christians took over in Spain. They started off with a king who was very tolerant and then became less tolerant. So, okay. Almost as soon as he arrived in Canaan, he was forced to leave to escape a famine. So what's the trial there?
Leaving again.
Okay, one of it is leaving again. Second is hunger, and what's the third? There's another,
yeah.
Yes, that's true, although that comes in the next one. But there's another trial implicit, hidden in number four, which Rashi so takes for granted that he assumes you'll understand. Wait, this is his promised land that he has to leave, right? So it's not just that he has to leave because he's hungry, it's not just that he has to go to Egypt, but here he finally gets to the place that God has promised him, and the rug gets pulled out from under him almost immediately. We'll come back to that theme. All right, then five Sarahs kidnapped by Pharaoh's officials, right? We know about that. Then six, the kings capture Lot, and Abraham's forced to go to war to rescue him. You remember that? The war of four and five kings. Seven, God told Abraham that his offspring would suffer under four monarchies. Remember in the covenant between the pieces, God talks about how they will suffer, your offspring. At an advanced age, he's commanded to circumcise himself and his son. He's commanded to drive away Ishmael and Hagar, and he's commanded to sacrifice Isaac. So when put this way, Abraham, this sort of gives a framework to Abraham's life and his struggle. When you put it this way, Abraham really did have, you know, at every turn, he had a major struggle. Okay? Now, let's look at Rambam's and look at the differences. The Abraham's exile from his family and homeland. That's his first one. The second is the hunger in Canaan after God assured him he'd become a great nation there. Okay, so there you have Rambam phrasing it in a way that lets you understand. Third, the corruption in Egypt that resulted in the abduction in Sarah. So why does Rambam put it that way, as opposed to Pharaoh's kidnapping Sarah? What's the trial to Abraham in the corruption in Egypt?
He's setting Abraham free from the whole guilt of introducing her as sister.
Yeah, go ahead. Exactly.
Was it Abraham's fault?
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Was Abraham's fault that people suffered because of his lie?
Abraham's fault in what way? I don't.
Because he lied to. He gave the impression.
Right. Well. Yeah. But what you're saying is that this kind of gets Abraham off the hook because it's saying the corruption in Egypt that resulted in it, as opposed to. But yeah, go ahead.
Not to become like the Egyptian.
Right. I'm thinking that he's also saying the trial of living in a corrupt society. And this, right, exactly, this is the theme in Noach, right? That Noach was tzaddik b'doro, he was righteous in his generation. The question is, what does that mean, in his generation? And can you be righteous, truly righteous, in a generation that's corrupt? So here, the trial is not giving Sarah up as much as it is living in a society that would demand such a sacrifice, in other words, being in a corrupt place. So let me draw a very bad analogy, but one that has a point. Yesterday we had a meeting for the fourth grade parents about technology. Okay? So and one of the presenters said, you know, 5 years ago I wouldn't have said to you, be careful how your kids text message on their cell phones. Because 5 years ago, as recently as 5 years ago, nobody would think to give a 10-year-old a cell phone. They still shouldn't, but some do, right? But 10 years ago, 5 years ago, nobody would even think about that, nor would they think about all the, I mean, YouTube is, what, a year or two old, and MySpace is a year or two old, and all these things. So forget corrupt or not corrupt. The point is that the society throws up challenges that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, none of us had to face, and However we solve them, they'll be different tomorrow and next week. Because if there's a MySpace today, there'll be a your space tomorrow and a his space the next day. And God only knows what's coming next. We have no idea the whole point. If we knew what was coming next, we'd all make a fortune and retire to Aruba, because we do it. But somebody out there is writing some software that I promise you will be challenging for our kids. Right? There's no doubt about it. So Avraham, for the first time, has to face a society in which he has to move as an actor. You know, he's not a kid anymore, and the society's corrupt. And Maimonides, who left a corrupt society, the Almohads, and a society of persecution for Cairo, where things were better, although still he's living, remember, under Muslim rule, must have thought more globally. And so that's what he sees as Abraham's trial, which I think is a really fascinating way of looking at it.
So what point did you make yesterday?
Oh, I wasn't presenting. I was just, I'm a fourth grade parent, that's all. And I was only there for the beginning of the meeting because I also had to hear about the secret Jews of Brazil. So there's never one thing going on in this place. There was a present, Sandy Malamud presented about the secret Jews of Brazil yesterday. Very interesting. I mean, I only heard part of it, but. She does really interesting work. She really does. All right. There is a wonderful example of how do you cope with a corrupt society, right? Do you convert? Do you leave? Do you pretend to be Christian? Which over time ends up in being Christian with some slight strange memories of being Jewish, you know? For generations we're Christian, but for some reason that I don't know that's lost in the mist of history, we always light a candle on Friday night. So, number four, the war with the four kings, which we already talked about. Number five, his marriage to Hagar after having despaired that Sarah would ever give birth. Do you see that above? No. That's an interesting one, that Rambam sees that as a trial, that he has to marry Hagar. Rashi doesn't. I would think, by the way, in some ways you would think of this as the reverse, because Rambam lives among the Muslims where polygamy is permitted, and Rashi lives among the Christians where polygamy is forbidden. So you would think that Rashi would see this as a trial and Rambam not. And I'm not quite sure, other than personal inclination, I don't know why it is. Yeah. No, Rashi had three daughters. Right. Rambam had one son. He had one son, Avraham. Just so that you can feel good about Rambam, I know that Rambam died when his son was 17. Okay? But his son spent his life elaborating, defending, so on, the teachings of his father. I mean, it was a very... You know, that was a successful father-son relationship. He revered his father, thought he was a wonderful man. One of those cases where he shared the opinion of the community, which, you know, doesn't always happen. It's like Mirabeau, who was the French revolutionary figure, who was called the friend of man. That was his revolutionary name. And his son, after he died, said the friend of man was friend to neither wife nor child. Right? Which often happens, but that wasn't true. But Rambam, I don't have his wife's testimony, but his son. But his son liked him a lot. The commandment of circumcision, right? Then he also mentions Avimelech's abduction of Sarah, which Rashi doesn't, presumably because he doesn't have enough space left, and he just includes it among Sarah. But they really are two separate trials. Right, Pharaoh's abduction and Avimelech's abduction, the same bad thing happens to you twice. Each time it's a different experience. No two experiences are identical. You can't step in the same river twice, as Heraclitus put it. Yeah.
Did Avraham actually marry Hagar?
Doesn't say that, but Rambam assumes that she did, Right. Yeah. Remember that there are three ways to betroth a woman in the Talmud, okay? Kesef, Shtar, and Bia. Kesef is with money, silver, right? Shtar is with a document, that's how we do it. And Bia is with intercourse. In other words, in the Talmud, if you have intercourse with a woman, you're betrothed. So Rambam was seeing this, I think, as a, you know, since he looked at it through the lens of rabbinic law, he saw it as a betrothal. to Hagar. If they had a child together, they were de facto married. So shtar is a document, a ketubah. Shtar means a ketubah, basically. Kesef is the betrothal that happens under the chuppah. You actually use kesef. When you get married, you do all three. First, there is the ketubah, which is the shtar. Then, under the ketubah, you can't be married if you don't give a ring. I mean, we use kesef as a silver ring. That's why it has to be unbroken and have no stones, because you have to know how much it's worth, right? And then biyah, intercourse, is traditionally supposed to happen right after the ceremony, right? You know that. That's what, after the ceremony, you go into yichud, which means aloneness, and two witnesses stand outside the door. And the couple, they stand outside the door both to prevent people from coming in, and also because afterwards, what do? You bring out a sheet that shows blood, which shows that she was a virgin, which is what you agreed on before the wedding, right? And even in today's ketubah, right, the term that you use, betulta, it presumes that the woman has never had intercourse before. And you use a different word if the woman has been married and is getting married again, because she's obviously not a betulta. So that idea is built into the wedding ceremony still. And afterwards, people still have yichud today, they still have aloneness today after the ceremony, but obviously it serves a different purpose. But that presumption is so that all three means of betrothal happen.
Yeah. I asked this again apropos number three when I said Rambam wants to set Avram off the hook. There seems to be over-identification with Avraham or needing to kind of justify his actions, like he really was despaired, like there was no other way that he could have acted.
Right, I think that Rambam believes that. Right, I think that Rambam does believe that there was nothing else that, I don't know, over-identification is more into Rambam's head than I want to go. I have no idea, but I think that he does believe that had Avraham not done this, it would have just resulted in his being killed and Sarah's being taken anyway. So, and he may be right. I don't know. I don't know.
So that he's making him more into a saint, is my
sense. He's making him into a tzaddik. Yes, which is what he believes he was. All the avot were tzaddikim in Jewish tradition. So in that sense, he's very much mainline of the Jewish tradition, right? The way that we read them is not the way the rabbis read them. It's not the way any pre-modern read them. Let me put it that way. So.
The
way that we read them psychologically is, which presumes that we, let me put it this way, it presumes that in some basic sense we're their equal, is not the way that rabbinic tradition read them, you know? It would, with very rare sort of hinting exceptions, you don't condemn Abraham, because he's Abraham. So, and whereas we're talking about Abraham as though he's another character and you can condemn or praise or whatever, but that's certainly not the way Rambam would have seen it. And also because the assumption is that had Abraham been like you or like me, he wouldn't have had that relationship with God. The closeness of Abraham's relationship with God is the proof that Abraham's different from the guy in the street. Okay. Yes.
I'm struggling with one thing. If that's the custom of the time about marriage, then Sarah's complaint about the God was really a faulty complaint, wasn't it? She had to recognize that there was a marriage.
Why was it? If that's exact. So her complaint was serious.
That you can treat as chattel.
Which complaint? The complaint
Sarah
that.
Sarah said, get rid of it.
That's not a complaint. That's an order.
Oh. How did she get to that order?
Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. She was resentful of either another. Well, remember that the woman started out as her concubine.
Right.
So I don't know legally. What we read was that legally she retains control over her, even if she becomes Abraham's second wife. Remember that our assumption about what a second wife is may not be their assumption about what a second wife is. So it's clear that Sarah had that right because it was exercised. But your assumption that the two, that she's now Sarah's equal, was exactly what Sarah was disputing. She's not my equal, and Abraham agreed, and so did God.
So that they didn't apply the rules of the three rules of betrothal.
No, they didn't apply the rule that you're positing, that all wives are equal.
I would never say a thing like that differently.
No, but seriously, I'm saying that your assumption is that Hagar's being a wife and Sarah's being a wife are the same thing. Sarah didn't see it that way, and neither apparently did Abraham. Rambam did, perhaps, I don't know, but Sarah and Abraham certainly didn't. And also, from our modern point of view, no, they certainly didn't apply those three rules, because that was 1,000 years before those rules were developed by the rabbis. So the fact that Rambam believes in those rules in the 12th century doesn't mean that Abraham did in the 15th century BCE, you know. Number 8 I find very interesting. Because it ties in very nicely with number 5. Right? That is, remember that Rashi doesn't give number 5, he only gives number 8, but Rambam's giving number 5 makes number 8 more poignant in that way. All right, that's another trial to Abraham. And he makes a separate one for number 9. Why? Why is it a separate one?
Because your child is supposed
to... Okay, one possibility is just that, you know, your child, you're supposed to be the protector. Obviously, the child is helpless. Yeah.
Because he lived with the Board of Islam, and at that time they were blaming the Jews for that, and he's like, okay, I'm fed up with
it. I have a feeling that the fact that Rambam lived in Islamic lands and that Rashi lived in Christian lands had something to do with this, right? I mean, Rambam, obviously, the Quran tells the story differently, but still, to be able to say the way the Torah tells it was a real trial to Abraham to send Yishmael away is, I think, a good thing. And the other point that I would make is that it's a separate trial because Avram doesn't have a son, and Yishmael's the one that he assumes is going to carry on the family tradition and inherit. And for Hagar, it's only, in quotes, an emotional tear to send her away. But for Yishmael, it's everything, right? It's posterity and economics as well as emotion. So they are two different trials in a way. And that's how Rambam uses them. And obviously, then the last one, I don't know if there's significance in the difference of wording, that for Rashi the trial was the command and for Rambam the trial is the binding. That may just be the way that they both say it, but they may intend the same thing. Okay, so, and you will notice, of course, that for Rambam, who is the rationalist, right? Everything on the list is from the Bible. Nothing is rabbinic. It's just that the rabbis of the Midrash say that Abraham lived his life with 10 trials, and then later commentators try to figure out what 10? What's the list?
Is it 10 like, in psychological terms, the elements of human, like courage?
Those kinds of lists can always be expanded or made smaller depending, you know, on what you... I think that really people, you know, I'm giving... my sermon this week is about 40 years since the 6-7 war. And 40 plays a very important role in the Jewish tradition. But I think that that has more to do with how the human mind works than it has to do with the realities of the world. You know, it's just that we find it easier to fix on 2s, 3s, 10s, 40s, those kinds of things. But the truth is, that even for every talk that anyone has ever given that says, let me tell you the three most important parts of courage, they could have done 6. You know, I'm serious, they could have done 5 or they could have done 4, but they don't for good reason, which is that it's easier to remember the 3 whatevers than it is to remember the 16 whatevers. So I'm always, whenever I see those lists, I'm always mindful that if you said to the person, give me six instead of five, they probably could do it. But those numbers help us organize. I mean, look, the way Cass has it set up, Leon Cass, he has 11 trials for Abraham. But I have to tell you, the 11 trials of Abraham is not nearly as good as the 10 trials of Abraham, right? The five books of Moses, exactly. All right. So let's look at Cass. K-A-S-S. And he sets up this very helpful chart. Abraham's trials. Called with a command and a promise, Abraham answers the call. So the first, for Cass, the first challenge is to actually answer the call. And then, by the way, at the very end, I'm going to tell you one last trial for Abraham that none of them have. And the binding is almost always called the last trial. And in fact, that's the name of Shalom Spiegel's book about the binding of Isaac. It's called The Last Trial. And you can understand why you would want to end with the binding of Isaac, because it's very hard to think of anything that could be worse than actually having to kill your child. But I will tell you one last trial in a second. Two, Sarah in trouble with Egypt. Three, trouble with Lot, and Abraham's having to part with Lot. No one else said that so far. But remember that, you know, here he travels to a new land with his brother's son, and he has to break up the business because they can't live together. And that certainly qualifies as a trial.
Rashi mentions in number 6.
What's that?
Abraham was forced to go to war to rescue.
That's the next one. That's number 4 in Cass's list. Number 3 is having to part with Lot in the first place. Number 4 is having to go to war to rescue Lot, right? Which is kind of like what Moses has to do in a different way. Remember, Miriam gossips about Moses. She gets leprosy, and then Moses has to pray to God to cure Miriam, who insulted him. 5, Hagar, the stranger woman, as host mother, and trouble with Sarah. He puts it in a much more modern anthropological way, but both of those things are a trial. It's not just that he has to have a child with Hagar, but also, obviously, that it causes all that domestic discord. Circumcision serves as a hospitable host to strangers. Now this, very interesting that he sees this as a trial. Some people, I suppose, do, and some don't. What's that? That's true. Immediately after surgery, right after the circumcision, he has to do that. Some people think of hospitality as more difficult than other people, I suppose. And to be hospitable to strangers, you know. Sodom, which neither of them mention, but is clearly a trial for Abraham. He has to see the destruction of the city, right? Then Sarah in trouble again. Then Yishmael being kicked out, and then the binding of Isaac. A different story. And it tells you once more how many different takes you can have on the same material, even when you're looking ostensibly for the same thing. And then, yeah, go ahead.
Can you give us some background about Leon Cass?
Yes, Leon Cass, who is the chairman of actually the Bioethics Commission for President Bush. He is a social theorist at the University of Chicago, and for many years he did a class on Genesis, and he published a book about it about 2 or 3 years ago, which is called maybe The Beginning of Wisdom, something like that. It has wisdom in the title. Very good book, and I've quoted from it before in the class. And this is his chart. So then, divine encounters with Abraham. This is also very interesting to see that there are 10 divine encounters with Abraham. Okay? There's the command to go, the promise of land, the promise of seed, and the increased promise of seed, the command and covenant. The next covenant, when God appears as a stranger at the tent, his promise of a son to Sarah, his command to banish Ishmael, his command to sacrifice Isaac, and then he finishes off by promising him again. And then other divine deeds that are not known to Abraham, where God works behind Abraham's back. When he sends plagues to Pharaoh to rescue Sarah, as far as we know, Abraham doesn't know about that. When he appeals to Hagar to return in the desert, Abraham doesn't know about that. When he destroys Sodom after Abraham goes, you know, after the conversation they have and rescues Lot, Abraham is not there, although he obviously finds out about it later. He sends a dream to Abimelech to rescue Sarah and remembers her, and then calls to Hagar and rescues Ishmael in the wilderness. All of those things are done outside of Abraham's presence, which shows you also that God is working in Abraham's life even when Abraham's not there and doesn't know about it. Okay? Now, there is one last trial of Abraham that we have not yet read in class, but we will begin next year with. What happens next at the very end of Abraham's life? Sarah dies. Right? Not only does Sarah die, it's actually two trials, if you really want to count it as that. Now, you can understand why everybody ends with Isaac, because, you know, anything after Isaac is a kind of anticlimax, which is true. But Sarah dies, and then what does Abraham do? Before he gets married, he has to buy land in Israel to bury her. So not only does she die, but the land that he's promised, he doesn't get. He has to negotiate for. He has to buy. And the first piece of property that he buys is a burial plot, which clearly is, if you were reading the whole thing and you weren't already prejudiced in terms of making Isaac's binding the trial, you would end with that trial, with the death of his wife, and everybody who's ever had a death in their family knows that actually the process of getting someone buried, no matter how easy it is a trial in and of itself. You know, I mean, it's just hard. Even if you have, this is both an advertisement and a suggestion, even if you have pre-need, right, which is a good thing to do, because that way everything is taken care of, and you choose a coffin and you choose a ceremony and so on when you're not in grief and when you're not upset. And then at the time, it's all automatically taken care of. Even if you've done that, it's still very hard to go to the mortuary and say, okay, yes, this is the plot and that's the coffin I chose. And I mean, that's why people don't buy cemetery plots in advance anyway, because it's so hard. And not only does Abraham have to do that, but he has to do it in the land that's supposed to be his to start off with, and he has to negotiate for it, right? There isn't even a fixed price for Ephron's land. So for all those reasons, I think if we were rewriting the trials, you might want to actually end with that. And remember, he's been married to Sarah, whatever their marriage was like, right? Through good and bad. When you've been married for 100 years, you know, the other person really is a part of you, after all.
And
yeah, it could. When you said it could be a relief, I have to tell you something actually about that. There is actually a Jewish law, not exactly about that, but there's a Jewish law that if a parent dies and leaves you a lot of money, right, you say both blessings, Baruch Hatov V'Hameitiv, which means blessed be God who is good and does good, and Baruch Dayan Emet, blessed be God the righteous judge. And the reason you say both is because you acknowledge that part of you is excited. You're about to get all this money. And rather than pretend that that doesn't exist, you say a blessing because God has given you, even in the moment of terribleness, God has given you something good that you acknowledge, and it frees you to be able to be sad, right? So there is something in acknowledging the good part of something awful. If you can speak it out loud, then it frees you to feel the awfulness of the awful. Yeah. Right.
Where everything began. Because in some ways, so it's really like another level of commitment to all the covenant, to the covenant.
And it's a fulfillment. It is a fulfillment because it's the first time that he has land in Israel and the first thing that he purchases. It is actually, in a way, it's a very nice end to the story. Of course, I was going to say, the truth is that the very end of the story is before he dies, he has all these children with Keturah, but which also in his hundreds is pretty, it's pretty spectacular. You know, it's like Robert Benchley, the humorist. They asked him what he wanted on his grave, and he said, "I want, here lies Robert Benchley, age 100, shot by a jealous husband." Abraham could have gotten that. It is a fulfillment. And the fact that he buries Sarah in Israel, and this is, by the way, for those of you who follow, I mean, this is why Hebron is so precious and so disputed, and why people who want to settle there don't want to give it up, because that's where Abraham buries Sarah, that's where the first plot of land in Israel is purchased. So whatever your political opinions, when someone says Hebron is precious to the Jewish people, it really is precious to the Jewish people. It is a nice culmination that he buries Sarah there, and that it's the beginning of taking possession of the land in the Bible.
It seems to me, if we're going to include Midrash.
Yes, absolutely.
Abraham smashing the idols is also a test.
Right.
He's overturning both the religious order and rebelling against his father and his father's livelihood.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know why Rashi wouldn't include it, and he included the other two, but you could certainly include his smashing the idols as a test, I would think. The only thing that I would say is that maybe the tests are things that he's subjected to against his will, and nobody told him he had to smash the idols. That was a choice. But the question is, once Abraham made the choice to be God's representative, all these things happened that he had to overcome. So I have to look back at the list, but look back at the list, I don't think there's anything that was his choice to do. He had to leave his family, he's commanded to. He had to go to Egypt because of the famine and so on and so forth. He has to drive away Ishmael and Hagar. Yeah.
I was wondering, after Sarah dies, do you have a sense of how long it takes for burial to happen?
It has to be almost immediately, because remember that there was no preservative for bodies. So
in terms of like purchasing the land.
Right. He has to do it right away. And we will next semester, after the high holidays, I'll bring you Nechama Leibovitz's analysis, which is really wonderful, of the negotiation of Abraham and Ephron, how they negotiate for the land. But so any questions about anything at all? Yeah.
Why, if Abraham occupied the land for so long, why did he then have to buy it again?
Because this was a burial cave, I guess, and he did... And presumably, where he was didn't have, I don't know if you were allowed or if it was customary, I should say, to turn just any place into burial. But this was a cave, but I don't know, it's a good question. Why couldn't he bury Sarah on land that he had lived on? I don't know. Yeah?
Is there any significance that he gets the cave from Ephron, who's a Hittite?
I think so, because the Hittites, what you were going to say. Right. Yeah, they stayed in the land for a long time. Right. That's which is a reminder, by the way, that the idea that the Israel came into the land and took over the land, it's not true. There's Avraham with a Hittite, and Bathsheba is 500 years later, who is married to a Hittite, who's a nice guy too. He's nicer than King David, who has him killed off. Yeah. Yeah.
If you could talk a bit about this shift, elevation from that, the postmodernism that you're in. When did that happen? How did that happen? Because I actually see it as another phase in spiritual growth, from seeing these fathers or mothers as idols or revered figures to our archetypes that we aspire to. It's more empowering
Right.
in terms of we could become them or parts of them could become them rather than being passive and disempowered, and we could never get to their level of spirituality?
So I would say that demythologizing the rabbinic figures, as well as, I mean, this happened in Christianity too. Bultmann writes about demythologizing the New Testament. Is the last, I mean, started in the Enlightenment, but it's really been the last 100 years. The last 100 years when people have begun to see the Bible, and not everybody, some people have begun to see the Bible as, and analyzed it as literature and not just as a literal word of God, and saw people in psychological dimensions. So the Hasidic tradition does some of it, but still sees people as much beyond. The Kabbalistic tradition obviously sees them as working inside of God, so their actions aren't comparable to anything human. It's a pretty recent development.
100
yeah.
years?
Yeah, or so.
I'm curious why we think that Cass did not include the sending away of Hagar as one of his 11. He sends away Hagar as one of them.
Probably because he's thinking now about it as a modern. In that time, sending a woman away who's not your wife, who's just been a concubine, probably wasn't so tough. There's no indication that Abraham loved her. So, you know, to send a kid away who's going to inherit, that's a problem. That would be my guess, that would be Cass's reasoning.
It's just interesting that both the rabbinic...
Right. Do, and he doesn't. Yep. Yeah.
I hope I'm not going too far astray, but as I've been reading about the Enlightenment, which is very fascinating, I can't help but thinking about Spinoza and Locke. Did they know, when I say that, I mean Locke and the Jewish thinker, did they know about each other? Because what Locke said was truly revolutionary.
Well,
it took the Jews a couple hundred years maybe after that to even get to each other. I thought the modernity began earlier in the 19th century.
The Enlightenment began before. Spinoza, right, who in the 1700s already said that the Bible was written by human beings, but the idea of biblical criticism, but it was a very rarefied, very highly, you know, I mean, Spinoza was excommunicated. It wasn't that no non-Jewish thinkers knew about Spinoza. There's actually a book that's a pretty good book called Leibniz, I don't remember what the title is, but it's about Leibniz and Spinoza. And he talks about the relationship between the two thinkers and how Leibniz went and visited Spinoza and argues that a lot of Leibniz's philosophy came from Spinoza. But biblical criticism began in the 18th century and even a little bit before, but most people didn't accept it. And even if they did, they still didn't do the kind of analysis of the individual figures that we're doing now until the 19th century really, really picked up with German scholarship and with Wellhausen, and it was a later development. Yeah. The Courtier and the Heretic. Sorry, that's what the book's called. Go ahead.
It seems to me that with Rashi and Ramban, but especially with Ramban, that the driving away of Hagar, the trial about it is that in those days, even in their world, a woman had value as property, as a wife was almost like a female.
Yeah.
Property, and especially a woman who had given birth, she has proven herself, and especially a woman who had given birth to a son. So, more so for Ramban,
yeah,
to consider it a separate trial than
right. Could be. It could be. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It'd be an interesting. Yeah. Yes. Right. Right. Maybe. I don't know.
And number two, yeah. Do you have any idea why Muslims believe that Ishmael was sacrificing someone?
No, I don't really know very much about the Quranic traditions in it. So,
yeah.
Oh, okay. But I'll try to get Reuben Firestone here and see if he can tell us about it. Would be an interesting thing, both for the class and maybe even for the wider. Okay, anything else? All right, so let's stand up, please, and we'll do Kaddish to Rabbanan, and then we'll wish you all a good summer. Yitkadal v'yitkadash shemei rabah, v'yalma divrachi rutei, v'yamlich malchutei, v'chayechon uv'yomechon uv'chaye dechol beit Yisrael, ba'agala v'izman kari v'imru, yehei shemei rabah mevarach li'olam u'omei omaya. Yit barach v'yishtabach v'yitpa'ar v'yitromam v'yitnase, v'yitadar v'yitale v'yitalal shemei dekudisha, le'ela ve'ela minkol birchata v'shirata, tush b'chata v'nechemata, da'amiron b'alma v'imru, al Yisrael v'al rabanan v'al talmidehon, v'al kol talmidei talmidehon, v'al kol man da'askim b'araita, di v'atra hadein v'di b'chol atar v'atar, yehe lehon ulchon shloma rabba china v'chista v'rachamim, v'chayin ariche u'mezonei revichhe u'furkana mikodam divishmaya, da'avuhon divishmaya v'imru, amen. Yehe shlama rabba min shemaya v'chayim alenu v'al kol Yisrael v'imru, ose shalom bimromav hu yase shalom alenu v'al kol Yisrael v'imru, amen. Great, see you next year.